This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Statistically, there's a stout correlation between book buyers and public radio listeners. And from my own experience, I found that a high percentage of WMRA listeners are interested in the writing of those books. Mark Saunders, acting head of the University of Virginia Press, recently published his first novel, Ministers of Fire. He sent me a copy, and I found it so beautifully written and such a cracking good story of political and personal intrigue that I could hardly put Ministers of Fire down long enough to make the requisite amount of radio. Through the lives of his characters, Mark Saunders connects some 1979 events in Afghanistan with post-9/11 events in China.
Yeah, I really didn't set out when I first started writing a novel to write a spy thriller at all. I set out to explain a period in history, and this is where I ended up. And it's partially because, you know, I lived with someone who was involved in this kind of work when I was growing up. And so the same as if I'd lived with a train engineer and wrote about trains. I mean, that was my world. So it's not that I adopted this in order to achieve some sort of commercial goal or even to necessarily achieve a literary goal. When it comes to plot, I like plot in fiction. I think it's important. You know, I think it reveals character. And really, that's why this is a somewhat heavily plotted book, the way that a John le Carré thriller is, that it does move along and there's a lot going on, because I think that's a good way to hang character in fiction.
Mark Saunders' father is Hal Saunders, who was Jimmy Carter's Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and is currently Director of International Affairs at the Kettering Foundation. This means that the shadowy other side of the world was as vivid a part of Mark's childhood as football. And what Mark Saunders does so remarkably in Ministers of Fire is bring alive the ordinary people with all their ordinary hopes, dreams, desires, needs, and fears, who live amidst the chaos that passes for foreign policy among the Afghani, Americans, and Chinese.
There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong.
Well, the book begins in Kabul, Afghanistan in 1979, and this is just when the Soviet Union is massing its troops on the northern border of Afghanistan to come in and support a government that's come to power in a coup. And the U.S. is still there. We still have an embassy there. And as part of the crossfire of this coup and the aftermath of this coup, the U.S. ambassador is killed. And that's the scene that opens the book. It's something that really happened, although I've adapted it to my own purposes. But it's something that really, in some ways, I feel sparked the world as we understand it today, where we talk about the Taliban, we talk about Al-Qaeda, we talk about fundamentalist Islam and the enmity of fundamentalist Islam for the West. Subsequent to the American ambassador being assassinated there, the American CIA started to fund the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters. And they did that largely in the north of Afghanistan to counter the coming Soviet invasion. The CIA worked with the Chinese intelligence services to do that. You've got essentially two triangles in the book. You've got this triangle between or among the Americans, the Chinese, and the Afghans. And then you've got a romantic triangle. And the seed of that romantic triangle is also set in Kabul in 1979 between the CIA station chief, his operative, and his operative's wife, who also works in the embassy. And the CIA station chief, Lucius Berling, begins an affair with his operative's wife, April. So the repercussions of these two triangles, the intelligence operation and the romantic, carry forward then to China in the months after 9/11. And at that time, we have American officials and Chinese officials who have a real interest in hiding this operation, in covering up this operation that they began in 1979, because in some ways 9/11 has been a consequence, blowback, to use the CIA term, of that original operation. And so the repercussions are played out largely in the streets of Shanghai in the spring of 2002.
You say this was your world growing up. So where was little Mark Saunders in all of this?
Not in a very romantic place. I was in Northern Virginia in 1979 watching all this on Nightline. My father was involved in the State Department. He was involved in Afghanistan and also in the Iranian hostage crisis during this time as the Assistant Secretary of State under Jimmy Carter.
You write about these places as though you know them, though. Did you live there?
No. I visited almost all of the places in the book, but never lived in any of them.
Did you talk about it a lot? There's such a sense of place in here.
We did talk about it a lot. It was really part of my world. It's part of my consciousness and maybe as sort of part of my budding imagination as a novelist. I would imagine what these places were like.
This is your first published novel, right?
It is.
What have you written before, Mark?
I've written some stories. I wrote a sort of Romana Clef in college that I did as my undergraduate thesis, but luckily that never saw the light of day, nor did I actually try to have it see the light of day.
When did you start this, and what made you start Ministers of Fire?
There are elements of this book that I wrote as early as 1995, so they really predate 9/11. I was interested, again, because my father was involved and friends of our family were deeply involved in Afghanistan in that period, in sort of sorting this out the way that, you know, another writer might sort out a parent's affair in a small town or in suburbia. I mean, I grew up in suburban America like a lot of kids did in the 1970s, but in some ways, because it was Northern Virginia and a lot of my friends' fathers and mothers did this kind of work, our worlds were expanded in that way. But at the same time, we were living in the weirdness of 1970s suburban America. So there are plenty of novelists. You look at a guy like Rick Moody, who writes, you know, The Ice Storm, about what amounts to an affair in suburban America. This is a book about, in some ways, an affair in suburban America, except it's taking place halfway around the world.
What did you write in 1995? What parts were you working out back then?
One of the first things I wrote was actually what is now part of the prologue, which is actually the scene in which the American ambassador is killed. The other part that I wrote first, and this was actually published as a separate short story, is an episode in the book, which I like to read because it's somewhat self-contained, exactly, about a part where a Chinese dissident who has escaped from state security is hiding out in a rural Christian church in China, and the Chinese authorities come to the church. And that's something that I wrote as a self-contained piece as part of this, but that I felt particularly strongly about. It's one of the earlier things I wrote in the book.
Felt strongly about it? Why?
I felt that it encapsulated sort of the issues of belief that I find that I was trying to work out in the novel. You have true believers of various sorts clashing in this novel, and I think that that's something that, you know, I know that's something I'm particularly interested in. I think it's something that drives the world we live in. So we have, in this case, practicing Chinese Christians, very dedicated Chinese communists, Americans who are dedicated to the projection of American power overseas, and these are all different flavors of true believers. And as we all know, true believers coming together can often have disastrous consequences.
How did you get interested in the concept of clashing true believers? Where does that come from?
I think it's just something that I've observed as driving the world that we live in. The Tiananmen Square massacre was particularly troubling for me. This is 1989. I think that my generation thought that the kinds of things that happened in Hungary in the 50s with the Soviet tanks, etc., were a thing of the past. We were witnessing a period in which the wall is coming down and authoritarian regimes are crumbling. And then we see this young student, roughly my age at the time, standing in front of a tank in Tiananmen Square and know that, you know, he probably didn't make it. And that was very emotionally, psychologically traumatic for me. I think, you know, other members of my generation may have focused on other things, but that for me, because of the international focus of my upbringing, really made a huge impression on me and caused me to travel to China and really try to see what it was like to live there under this regime.
You talk about your generation. You want to put that in time for people who weren't looking at you?
Sure. I'm 45, so I was 23, three in 1989. Yeah.
The passion of early. Well, I hope we tote some of that passion around with us still. But
yeah, I mean, it's a different. My generation's different from the baby boomer generation, and I think maybe to some degree we have a slightly different relationship to this type of true belief. We are a little bit more measured about how quickly we jump into idealism than the previous generation, because we witnessed the aftermath of that generation in some ways.
Meaning what?
Well, we lived in the 70s. We grew up in the 70s. We didn't grow up in the 60s. We weren't rebelling against growing up in the 50s. What we were in some ways rebelling against were parents who got deeply involved in the 60s with some of the wreckage that resulted from that.
And who named their children Moonbeam.
Yes, well, luckily, my parents grew up in the 1930s, so they did not name their children Moonbeam.
I want to get into some specifics. I loved your writing.
Well, thank you.
I thought it was vivid and specific and surprising without being self-consciously so. I actually found myself in a place I've never been and will probably never go to, which to me is the point of good fiction.
Well, it is. And I think, I mean, there are two elements to that. One, I think, is restraint, and the other is engaging your senses. And sometimes those two things can be in conflict, right? I mean, we all actually are sometimes unrestrained as a result of our senses. So you want to engage the reader's senses so that they not only see what you're trying to see in your head, but they smell it, they taste it, they feel it, all those sorts of things. But in terms of the prose, I think restraint is important, because if you always have the volume turned up all the way, you're going to miss a lot of the range. So if you turn the volume down, then you have the opportunity for effects when it's necessary to achieve them.
I marked this passage just because I thought it was quite wonderful. Right. And if you could set it up and then just read it so people
sure.
could get a sense. It's right there.
Absolutely. So this is a point in the prologue where Lucius Burling, the CIA station chief, has taken his girlfriend, April, the wife of his operative, to northern Afghanistan for a meeting with the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters, and the Chinese. And they've actually consummated their relationship the night before in Samarkand, which is a Central Asian city. And they've arrived at Mazar-e-Sharif, which is an old British airfield from the Great Game in northern Afghanistan. And they've landed there, and they're there for...
What's the Great Game?
So the Great Game is a term for the clash of empires, largely the Russian and the British empires in Afghanistan and to some degree Persia and Western China, that started really in Jefferson's time and carried through. It's really in some ways still happening today. I mean, I've been reading a book about the 1950s in Iran, and the last vestiges of the Great Game are alluded to in that book. So, you know, we're still in some ways in the Great Game today. But this feels very much like Great Game stuff, because you're in Afghanistan, you're in the northern part. British explorers, very intrepid guys, spent their lives tracking and mapping these areas. And the prize was India. Russia wanted India. The British obviously wanted to protect it. And Afghanistan was the no man's land in between.
This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. And before the break, I was talking with Charlottesville's Mark Saunders about his first novel, Ministers of Fire. We'd covered the plot, which begins in Afghanistan in 1979 and skips to post-9/11 China, and we'd met the central characters, among them Lucius Burling, an idealistic but flawed product of America's intelligence establishment. And we talked about the Great Game. Now, as we pick up the conversation, Mark Saunders will read a passage from the 1979 section of Ministers of Fire.
We're actually here in the mind of April, Lucius Burling's girlfriend, and they've just gotten off this little Cessna plane at the airfield, and the he that I'll begin with here is Lucius Burling, the CIA station chief. He hailed the pilot and turned toward the plane, but before he took another step, they had begun to hear the sound of a small band of men riding down from the hills. Not a sound exactly, but a sudden disturbance in the ceaseless wall of wind, the creak that is made by tack flailing the muscles of lathering horses. The pilot, smoking by the wing of the plane, reached for the holster on his hip, but Burling made a damping motion with his hand. Shapes emerged from the brown pack until each was an individual rider and animal, bearing down across the hard pan in a clatter of hooves, and drawing up, veins bulging in necks dark with sweat. April watched them with her mouth half open, her hands raised slightly from her hips, as if she were about to appeal to them for something. Mercy was the word in her mind. The air had stopped in her mouth. Saliva seeped from the insides of her cheeks, but her throat was bone dry. This was the first place she had been where she knew that being American didn't matter.
After I read this, I started thinking about how Americans do always feel as though it should matter that they're Americans.
That's right. And I think Westerners, you know, the imperial powers have had that feeling for quite a while. I mean, you think about Paul Bowles characters in North Africa and the Sheltering Sky running up against these tribes who could care less that they're British. It doesn't matter. There's the draw of the exotic here. And then there's the question of, you know, how far out do you have to go to where the group that you're dealing with does not care about the reach of American power, British power, or Dutch power in Africa in the 19th century or what have you?
Most of us Americans don't really think about that or don't have any context to think about that. Does that come from your childhood or your education or your travels?
All three.
All three?
Yeah.
Was it born in your childhood?
I think so. But I think when you travel to some of these places, when you travel to Central Asia, it is about as far from Central Virginia as you can get. And that's the draw of it. That's why people go there. That's what's drawn adventurers there for centuries. But when you actually get there, you realize that you are far away from the long arm of American ideals, whether real or imagined.
Yeah, it's like when you get it caught in an undertow in the ocean and you realize very simply that the ocean is bigger than you are.
And yeah, that's a great way of thinking of it. There's a scene in the book where Burling looks out of a plane and he looks at what is really just a sunset. I mean, it is the sun reflected on clouds, and he's actually frightened by it because it's so indifferent to him. And that's, in some sense, what we're talking about here is, and that's true about natural forces, the ocean, lightning, you know, storms like we've had the past couple of weeks.
Just the great grinding wheels of life. I mean, in this book, life kind of grinds on and sort of gobbles people up willy-nilly.
Yeah, the forces of ambition grind people up, and whether it's national ambition or personal ambition or the conflict between the two.
Mark Saunders writes about place with the assurance of someone who's not only been there, but experienced there. So we're in China, 2002, and I just want to read one sentence. The late afternoon was struck dumb by its unblinking witness to drudgery, and the whiteness and breadth of the sky reminded Lee of his posting in Tibet. I want to talk about that first part. The late afternoon was struck dumb by its unblinking witness to drudgery. Have you seen that in China?
Absolutely. In fact, there's a very vivid scene in my head of a farmer being pulled across his paddy by a water buffalo, and the animal and his own relationship to the surroundings. We just talked about being smaller than forces around us, whether it's weather, other natural forces, or the force of history. In the case of a Chinese farmer, all of those forces are acting on it. And he's an agent in his own life, and he is affecting them too. But when you observe that, the feeling you have is the same feeling we have when we contemplate, you know, how big the universe is. It's almost crushing.
Do you remember writing that sentence?
Absolutely, yeah.
How long did it take you to get it like that, to get it so concise and so specific?
That sentence is one that I think came fully formed. The fear with a sentence like that is that it sounds too literary somehow.
Writerly.
You know, is it true? And then you have to, and One of my teachers at UVA was Deborah Eisenberg, this incredibly great short story writer. The specificity and the unpretentiousness of Deborah's sentences are really remarkable. And she said, you know, I'm sure everybody's always told you that you're a good writer. And she left it at that. In other words, you're not as good as you think you are, right? It's like going into, you know, August football practice and having a coach kick your butt. And that's what she was essentially doing. And so that sentence is one that, you know, there's a fear that it does sound too writerly. And so then you have to interrogate it incredibly closely. Say, is this true? Does this mean what I want it to mean? Or does it just sound pretty or profound or something that, you know, writers are supposed to sound? In that case, I felt that it passed muster. Now, you know, other...
Well, I obviously did,
and
too.
I guess that you did too, right? Which is, it's yeah. good news, and that's what matters. I mean, if it sounds false to you, then it doesn't matter how it sounds to me.
No, why I liked it is because I felt like I could inhabit. I mean, I was there and could inhabit the characters just with those few words, and I loved that you didn't describe it any further. You know, you just left my... I guess I loved it because it engaged with my imagination so fully. I wasn't even thinking about your writing. I was thinking about the place.
Well, and that's the last thing that a writer wants is for the writing to call attention to itself. And I think all writers look back at books that they've written and find sentences that violate that. And then they find sentences that actually you know, make them smile because they seem to work still.
And then there's the character and characters of China. The latter represented by, among others, a man who was a colonel during the 1979 incident in Afghanistan, but by 2002 has become a very powerful general.
The colonel who meets Sperling in Mazar-i-Sharif becomes a very high-ranking general. He's the Minister of State Security. So you can think of that as being the head of the FBI and the CIA wrapped up into one. He's also a member of the Politburo, and we've heard recently with the transition of power in China what that involves. So he's a very, very powerful man and was one of the men who gave the order to march on Tiananmen Square to crush the student uprising. And so he, throughout the book, continues both in his own head and then in conversation with Sperling, with whom he feels some affinity, to contemplate what freedom means. And for the Chinese, of course, if you talk to Chinese officials, they will say that they need to keep control. They have a nation of several billion people, that it's important to maintain control. Americans talk about the importance of freedom, freedom of thought, freedom of religion. These are things that are explored in the book. Freedom of religion is explored specifically in the book with the church. So General Ze is here thinking about the implications of freedom. Freedom, the general repeated. He seemed to recognize the sound of the word, but he pronounced it with suspicion. The Minister of State Security would have ordered the march on the square. General Ze would still be in prison, like Zhao, if he'd opposed it. Freedom was something that scared the Chinese. Indeed, it scared most men, as it should. The cost, after all, was more than the average modern man, even American, was prepared to accept. The months since 9/11 had proven that.
Okay, thank you. Now, talk about it, if you would, please.
It was interesting for me to write about, to go back in some cases. I mean, I wrote some of this in the months after 9/11, but also to go back when I was going through the book to revise it more recently, and to remember what it was like in the spring of 2002. So on the one hand, we have the Patriot Act and people arguing about how much freedom people should have and how much safety they wanted. And I remember arguing with friends who were otherwise, in my mind, relatively liberal-thinking people who seemed ready to give up a fair amount of freedom in return for security because they were scared. So that was one thing. The other thing about those months is that it was before the Iraq War, and I think it's important to remember how much the Iraq War muddied our thinking about 9/11.
Do you want to say anything more about exactly what you mean by that?
Well, if the Iraq War hadn't happened, number one, we squandered a lot of goodwill that we had. I mean, after 9/11, most of the world was on our side. We'd been attacked innocent people had died is horrific. And the general feeling in the world was that America had been wronged here. We then went out and spent most of that goodwill capital in Iraq.
Ministers of Fire is no modest first effort at novel writing. It is, to my mind, a disquieting journey into the complex world of post-9/11 political intrigue. And that intrigue is layers deep in this book, embedded in Mark Saunders' gorgeous handling of character, landscape, and language.
I don't know enough about chemical processes to come up with a good metaphor for this, but you are trying to, in some ways, compact a whole universe of different forces into a plot, a character, a scene. And at the same time, it has to feel real. So you have to come up with the right, in terms of character, in terms of what they do, in terms of where they do it. Those all have to be carefully constructed so that they mean more than just what is going on between them, what they're saying to each other. I think when you talk about some of the forces that make a novel work, you want every piece of dialogue, no matter how concise, to convey more than one meaning. You want the reader to feel very strongly, the same way we feel in conversation, that someone is meaning more than what they say. If we know the background of what they're saying, if we know something about them, if we're in a work situation or a romantic relationship, and we feel that our partner is actually saying a lot more than they are with their words, a novelist has to convey that through the character and has to have let the reader know this is what the character's about, this is what hovers over this situation. And in some fiction, in, let's say, domestic fiction, you have a dialogue between a parent and child or between lovers or what have you, and there's maybe two or three levels of meaning. And what I've tried to do here is not only have those personal double or triple meanings, but also have a sort of historical, political, world historical level to what they're saying and doing too.
Now, wait a minute. Did you know you were doing all that when you were writing Ministers of Fire? Or did you just do it with your gut?
No, it's conscious. I mean,
it's conscious.
In some ways,
it's not cloggier prose if there's all this consciousness.
It can. And you have to unclog it.
You'll find a link to Mark Saunders' website on the Spark page at WMRA.org.